listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the end of a long three-day session, but it's more special because it's called a special panel. Give a hand for all our panelists, which I'll introduce. Please give a hand. And what's this all about? The title of this special discussion is the role of social security in realizing human rights. UN Research Institute for Social Development is celebrating their 50th anniversary, you know. So they are a very old organization, but very with fresh ideas, am I right? So together with Forum Asia, who also wants to do an event in conjunction with the 20th, Vienna plus 20, basically, 20 years on since the Vienna process. So they've put together this forum to try to provoke a deeper thinking. And I'm going to introduce the panelists. The panelists here have loads of experience. So I'm just going to call out their name. We'll give a clap and I'm going to pass the mic for them to say in two sentences or three a little bit about what your experience and your background. So the first we have with us, Mr. Santosh Mehrotra, who is the Director General of the Institute of Applied Manpower Research, the Planning Commission, the Government of India. So let's give a hand to Mr. Santosh. Welcome him, yeah?
I'm a human development economist, and after many years in university, I moved to the UN system and spent 15 years in the UN system internationally, and 6 years ago, for the first time in my life, I'm working for my own government. We've just written the India Human Development Report. If it makes you feel I'm less government than most of the people on the panel.
Okay. And now our next speaker is Il-Chung Yi, who's a research coordinator of UNRISD.
Good afternoon. I'm Il-Chung Yi, research coordinator of UNRISD. I better talk about my institution rather than myself. I think there was a kind of critical comments on UN system or UN body throughout whole discussions over the 3 days. But I think we have to know UN is very much complex body composed of different components and different aspects, different activities. So there are so many different institutions with a different focus on different activity, and our institution is focusing on alternative developmental path. So our mandate is to keep the distance from the mainstream thinking and then try to find out alternative strategy for development. So we are kind of an outsider within the UN system and much closer to civil society. That's my personal opinion, but civil society people I met consider our institution like that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And our third speaker, who's coming from Southeast Asia or Southeast Brazil, his name is Armando de Negre Filho, who's with the World Social Forum for Health and Social Security, the Executive Committee and Coordinator of the Health Policy and Systems Innovation Laboratory Heart Hospital in Sao Paulo.
Thank you. Well, I'm at this panel on behalf of the World Social Forum on Health and Social Security. This is a space, a thematic branch of the World Social Forum that we began to organize around 10 years ago. We developed a different World Social Forum on Health and Social Security since 2002. And along this time, our main concern is to introduce the debate about the universal access to health and healthcare. It was original motivation. After some years, we realized that it was impossible to propose a human rights-based universal approach to health and healthcare outside a full social security concept, where the other domains of socio-economical rights could be articulated, education, work, pension system, housing, etc. And at the same time, our trajectory asked the connection with the civil and political and cultural rights. So nowadays, our platform is around the conception and the implementation of universal social security on this broader perspective systems around the world. And we even organized a world conference with governments and civil society 2 years ago, with 99 countries projecting this debate of universal approach and systems.
Thank you.
The next person on the panel is our colleague, a friend, a human rights defender, who's been talking to us the last 3 days. Maina Kai, who's a UN Special Rapporteur on the right to freedom of peaceful assembly and association.
I was asked to speak here not as UN Special Rapporteur, but really as and in terms of the linkage between social security issues and the struggles that we're having in Kenya and some parts of Africa. So I'll do the best I can with that hat. So in this session, I am now representing the entire continent of Africa.
and its descendants,
wherever they may be.
That's all of us. Okay, and you're a lawyer, human rights lawyer in Kenya, right?
Yes, I am. But what I do now is that I do community organizing. I'm working at the grassroots, working with different communities and using film as a way to convene people and documentaries to convene people and start a discussion and conversations around issues of social justice and issues especially of leadership. And that's because our analysis is that the problems we have are related to leadership, and rather than addressing the leadership question from a top-down perspective, we're trying to get it from a bottom-up, because we basically have some sorts of some space, and we have elected leaders, but we don't seem to be electing with our interests in mind as opposed to their interests, and we get bought easily, and there's a lot of corruption around that vote buying, and we end up having really horrible leaders, such that today our members of parliament are easily the best paid parliamentarians anywhere in the world, anywhere in the world. We just the other day passed a new law that gives the president $1 million gratuity upon retirement. But on top of that, he gets a monthly income in pension of about $20,000 a month. So he gets a gratuity and then he gets payment. The members of parliament also voted an increase in their gratuity to be about $50,000. And then they will also get a pension of about $10,000 a month. So we have got the fantastic, if anybody wants to make money, please come and be a member of parliament in Kenya. It's very, very easy. It's easy. It's easy to get elected, and because you just buy your way and then you'll make it up very fast.
Okay, thank you. So the social security of the members of parliament in Kenya are resolved. Huh? They've got it worked out for at least about 200 people in the whole of Kenya. And our next on the panel is Rebecca Brown. She's also been with us in the last 3 days from ESCRnet, coming all the way from the US.
Thanks. I'm a human rights lawyer and I'm the deputy director of ESCRnet. I haven't had a chance to also mention my organization, so I'll do something similar. ESCRnet is a global network of organizations which work on social justice using the human rights framework. We focus on developing cross-regional solidarity and collective action. So similar to what Forum Asia is attempting to do in this region, we're attempting to do across regions. We work on litigation, economic policy, corporate accountability, women's rights, monitoring. We have several programs, and if you're interested in potentially being involved, let me know.
Our final person on the panel is Ms. Beth Lexan Pagio from the Philippines. She's also been with us for the last 3 days.
My organization is the Network for Transformative Social Protection. So I will also introduce my organization. This is a network composed of grassroots organizations, people's organizations, NGOs, who came together through the Asia-Europe People's Forum process and agreed to launch a campaign to assert the people's right to dignity. So it has been relatively new. We were organized in 2009, and we are still trying to launch kick off the campaign in Asia. My background mainly is on campaigning and policy advocacy, mainly on the issue of debt, budget, and environmental issues. And before joining the network, I've been part of the Philippine National Anti-Poverty Commission as a focal person for the sector on farmers and landless workers.
My name is Gerald Joseph with Dignity International. I'm based in Malaysia. Our work is focusing on economic, social, cultural rights and human rights-based approach to development. Okay, we're going to start not with the panelists, but I think we've agreed that we want to start with the participants. In Article 9 of the International Covenant on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights, which is an old document, since 76 in force, it says, very short article, it says, the state parties to the present covenant recognizes the right of everyone to social security, comma, including social insurance. Okay, thanks. Anyone from the panel wants to take on from where Santosh has mentioned, trying to separate the how the conceptualization of this Rebecca.
I was actually struck by hearing all of these comments a bit differently. If we're thinking about as activists or as many of you as journalist defenders, and we think about using the right to Social Security practically in our advocacy, I was actually struck by, to some extent, the relatively arbitrary lines between calling it the right to Social Security or calling it the right to food or the right to health. Because I think that these are all just tools or perhaps frameworks for actually realizing substantive change in people's lives. And at a certain point that requires systems, which I think Social Security largely is referring to the range of what that implies, but that it's also referring to we need Social Security in order to realize substantive rights such as health, access to health, access to food, access to housing. So I think that although perhaps there are different aspects of ensuring dignity, as someone in the audience said, I think that to a certain extent what it means in our actual work is more procedural or legal than substantive in many ways. And I'm wondering, I'm sure we'll have more discussion, but hearing from all of you in terms of to what extent using these different labels or naming rights in particular ways is useful or actually undermines your ability to articulate what you're looking for in terms of change in your communities.
Thank you.
I think this is a very interesting and fundamental debate because in a certain way this debate about the concept of social protection established a kind of it's important barrier in the debate, especially because the ILO tradition expressed this very formal work dimension that is established that social security is traditionally composed by right to health, work protection, and pension. That's very traditional three dimensions of that. And many constitutions around the world establish social security as that. Linked to the formal work. When I like to insist the idea that when we project that in our societies, with a broader dimension of populations with no formal link to work, the social protection concept could be much more interesting, but not as a separate branch, but as an umbrella for that. Robert Castel in France proposed that, no? Yeah? So social protection system is umbrella, where the right to work, the right to pension, the right to social security, in a certain sense, is there, including the idea that we could have a civil security, where are the right to civil and political rights, no? The social security and economical security within this place. So, I think this understanding, much more comprehensive understanding, that's much more organic to the concept of human rights as a systemic approach, no? All dimensions of life, it's extremely important because it's a collective approach as a society. No more the division between formal workers and families of them and the rest of society. So it's a projection of a de- day where we need to define the citizenship, no, material dimensions of life, and the role of the state in front of these social protections challenge. It would be extremely important to define the role of economy in that. I mean, must economy be organized to sustain a social protection system in order to have dignity for everybody living on this society contract, I mean, society sharing? I think this is the perspective, no? That's good for the debate in terms of democracy, no? The radical concept of democracy as social justice. No? So in this sense, it's very useful. Otherwise, the division that is proposed today, insisting proposing of this perspective of ILO, could divide the different parts of this debate. And if you consider that today there is a very strong agenda around the social protection floors proposed by ILO, by G20, by Bachelet Report, etc., we are facing a quite big challenge for human rights today. Because proposed social protection floors means the minimum package, basic package, is an action against the rights, in my opinion. Because we are reducing the concept of rights to certain dimensions that could be affordable and that will be different in terms of benefits according to the capacity of people to afford their own needs or to be covered or not by the different schemes in society. I think this social protection perspective based on human rights is a very broad and everybody will be included on that with no kind of difference in terms of needs and benefits. And this is strong.
Okay, I want a voice from another continent, but I see. Okay, Yuchong, you can go ahead while Africa is preparing itself for the comeback. Yeah.
Sorry for taking the floor again, but very briefly, if I might. Armando, don't get me wrong. It's not that I subscribe. It's not that I subscribe to the notion of the ILO notion. The ILO notion of social security did arise from their fixation with the formal sector of the economy. I come from a country where, even more than in your economy, 93% of the workforce is informal, when you include agriculture. So when I conceive of social insurance, and in India generally, it's not just me, there is increasingly recognition of the fact that social insurance is required for those who are in the informal sector. A recommendation to that has been made by a National Commission for Enterprises in the Unorganized Sector. And there is already incremental effort going on in that direction. So it's not that we, it's not true. It's going to be entirely funded for the poor by the government. So not contributive at all. So the point one is making is that I was just making terminological clarifications. And those are necessary if you're going to not sort of talk at cross purposes or have a dialogue of the deaf. All I'm suggesting is that it's perfectly possible to have social insurance for those in the informal sector.
Thank you. Those conceptual and definitional debates are going on and on. I mean, because scholars and international organizations are using different concepts for different entities or different bodies. So I think Rebecca's comment is quite important. How can you use this concept for social change or political change? I'd like to talk about social security from that perspective. I mean, maybe we can have two ways to change society through this social security concept. One, legal concept. You know, when every nation has their own concept of social security within legal system. The other way is we can use social security as a political demand and ethical demand. And this one, political demand and ethical demand, is related to conceptual problem and universalism. If we think social security is a security for all, in every dimension which is important to decent life, I think we have to demand it wherever we are. So I think this ethical and political demand oriented concept of social security is quite important in terms of political strategy to change the society. And in that sense, maybe we can define social protection as broader concept than social security, or we can define social security broader concept than social protection, but we have to have principle based on this ethical and political demand as political strategy.
Just to follow up on that, I think really the issue and the question we talked about, dignity, was the one that really moved. I think at the end of the day, when you look at this topic about realizing human rights, it's for me, human rights is really about dignity. It's living your life with all forms of dignity, free from torture, free to express yourself, free from hunger, the ability to work. All those things for me are linked to in terms of what human rights is. So we can, we'll sit and have debates about social insurance and other things, but I think the key is in realizing human rights. I think that other part of it is just a role, is how do we use that in realizing human rights? And that is where the debate ought to be. How do we, what are the tools we can use to be able to give people, to be able to enable people have a life in dignity? And in that context, for me, it's a bit boring from where you're going to. It's really that idea of raising expectations among people so they can demand more. And what I've learned over time is that when people have very low expectations, they don't demand. They just keep quiet and take it and say, there's only God. There's only God. You know, in Africa, we talk about God every day. We just pray to God. Maybe with God's wishes, we'll do this. Inshallah. Everything is inshallah. So we pray. And what really we need to do now is build up that anger and a demand system. Because it's, you know, I mentioned when I started about this enormous salaries of our members of parliament and our political leadership. But part of it is really trying to get people angry. And they say, you know, but I see a member of parliament around, we should stone him. Because we shouldn't just be sitting there around like that. And that's get enough anger and say, why does he get this for my taxes and I get nothing out of it? Oh, but that doesn't stop corruption at all, my friend. Of course, as you know, there's nothing, there's no link between high salaries and lack of corruption. Absolutely not. In fact, the more salary, because we saw Wall Street, man.
Okay. We'll unpack this high salaries, whether it's actually helping in the social security demand, because the Kenyan context is that you walk in Nairobi, it's walking in about 40% or 60% of Nairobi is people living in slums. And so when you have that crass poverty, you know, and the whole demands of dignity is actually there, and then you get a parliament that is actually debating already a negative budget with increasing this. So then you ask the question, where does the focus lie in realizing human rights? So Beth, so I was going to give the final comment for this round, and then I'm going to go back to you. I'm going to give you a minute to digest this, and then some questions from you, and then we'll have another round, so that you're also part of this debate. Isabel?
Okay. I just like to share the debates, now, how the network on transformative social protection was formed. Since these are grassroots organizations and people's organizations, this discussion was a result of analyzing the global crisis. There has been so much increase in joblessness, access to essential services as a result of globalization, privatization of health, education, and water and electricity. All those things that deprive people of this basic rights, including housing and food. So, since this is a debate, a discussion among development organizations, the groups have come up with, isn't it our right to live a life of dignity? So, we were now thinking, looking at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights for handles on how to assert all these many, many deprivations that we are experiencing under this existing development models. So the debate actually on terminologies for the grassroots organization is not so much, I mean, that is something to be discussed, but the reality is there is poverty and inequality that is happening in all over the globe.
Okay, thank you. The reason I think we need this space is because it's a good topic only because that if you notice that all the meetings we've had, we've conveniently not had a discussion on Article 9 on social security. Most human rights discussions, even the ESA rights framework, this is like, it's difficult, so let's discuss right to food, right to, you know, the hardcore issues, you know. But this one we are unpacking, and I think this debate is actually challenging us to how come we have not clarified what is it that we want our governments to do in social security? They are planning and planning and introducing all kinds of schemes, and still yet we don't have a human rights critic or a human rights demand. Yeah, there's two. I already see two hands. Can the mic please travel to? Can you pick up your hand? Yeah, person. Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You introduce yourself.
Francine Mestrom, Global Social Justice, Brussels, Belgium. It's a very interesting debate, I think, and I would like to stress how important this conceptual debate is, because as someone said already this afternoon, the words we use are important. And I would just like to give two examples. There is this concept of social insurance. I do not know how it came into the text of 1966, but I do know what the World Bank means by it today. Because for the World Bank, when it put poverty on the agenda in 1990, it explicitly and repeatedly opposed poverty reduction to social insurance. Poverty reduction was said to be a common interest, a mission for the state, whereas social insurances were not a common interest, were a vested interest, and was not a mission for the state. If people wanted social insurance, so the World Bank said repeatedly, people could buy it on the market. It was a private matter, a matter for the private market. And I think if we use the concept today, we should not forget it, that for neoliberals, let's say in general, social insurances are a matter for the private market. And the second example I would like to give is if whether we talk of social security, social protection, social development, whatever, but we should try to know what exactly we mean by it, what it covers. Because again, after the failure of poverty reduction policies, international organizations are today talking of social protection flaws, as Armando already said, or social protection in different ways. But if you look at what they mean by it, it is a purely economic project. They do say, oh yes, it is a human right, full stop. And then they start giving all the economic advantages. It is an economic stabilizer, it promotes growth, it promotes productivity, etc., etc., etc. And I think that if we really want to link it to human rights, we cannot refuse that economic discourse, but we have to complete it. And we have to complete the whole human rights discourse and stress the human rights discourse, because otherwise we're going to be stuck with an economic project of social protection that will not be enough to really realize human rights.
Thank you.
Okay, we pass on. I see this gentleman in the middle. This one, that's the one in the, yeah, yes. And then followed by the one, and then right at the back. Okay? So we'll take these four comments and we'll have a round from the panelists. Go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Jorge Carrillo. Until a couple of years ago, I was a UN staff. Now I'm a freelance consultant on social development. And I've been working mainly in Southeast Asia on issues related to social protection. Now, what I have is a series of comments, taken from the last speaker. I think it's very important to keep in mind that a lot, at least in this region, a lot of what's called social protection or even social safety nets after the 97 crisis or the 2008 crisis were actual economic protection. And they didn't have any qualms about it. I mean, policymakers were saying things like, we need social safety nets so that the poor don't stop spending. Because we need, you know, we need that money. So it's very open, and that is linked to something that affects the topic that we're discussing here. Is that in many countries of this region, and this is a very big contrast with Latin America. I come from Venezuela. Social development is not a goal in itself. The human development is not a goal in itself. They only exist as subordinated to the economic growth and economic expansion. So when we discuss about the concepts and try to put it in terms of human rights, we have to keep in mind that there are countries where this track basically doesn't exist. Very often, being from Latin America, I've got in discussion saying, well, how come that in Latin America CCTs are so popular, it's so effective? How come that in Latin America social policies are, you know, something that it's on the table all the time? And what I think is that a lot of these countries, at least in Southeast Asia and maybe in East Asia, they don't have the notion of human rights, of equality, of human dignity built into the system, if you want to call it somehow. Whether we like it or not, in Latin America, it's a Western culture. Kind of distorted, but it's a Western culture. And so these notions of human rights come from the same place that they come in Europe. I was telling somebody that the notion of development in Latin America came at the time that development was equated with civilization. Being developed was to be civilized. So that already introduces a different dimension. So it's very difficult then to extrapolate the experience of Latin America with what's going on currently in Asia. So this discussion has to be, for at least Southeast Asia, has to be, if you want, packaged in a different manner so that it can have the impact that Il-Chung and Rebecca were mentioning.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad the speakers are keeping to the 3 minutes because I'm watching the time. Thank you very much. Our next speaker, yes, please.
Thank you, Jared. I'm very glad that at least in this forum, the social security things have been brought.
Maybe you can introduce yourself.
Okay, I'm Altaf from Human Security Alliance, but representing our member Rick from Bangladesh. Again, I'm very glad that the social security things has been brought here as a part of human security, human rights discourse. But as if all of you can understand, which has a very intrinsic relationship with the notion of human security. Thus, the overlapping aspect of human security, human development, and human rights need to be clarified once you are taking the lead of the human social security things. If that is the case, then what should be the role coming up of the human rights bodies within the UN as of the response to the human social security when there is a UNDP and there's another set of already mechanism and set of arrangement is there which is responding human security, the Commission of Human Security within the UN system. Now, this reconciliation between these two aspects is very crucial when we're talking about social security as of a concept of human rights. But of course, my understanding is, as of my own experience, these are complementary. And this goes hand to hand. And obviously, for Asian perspective, it is very important at the moment, which comes with a different package. I mean, someone called it social safety net, someone calls it incentive, someone calls it progressive realization, or whatever people call it as positive discrimination. But whatever we call and how we want to repack this thing, it is the concept that brings human rights, human development, and human security all three together. Nothing is actually dispensable from each other. So this is the major theoretical and conceptual linkages that I want to brought. The second issue that I also want to introduce is that as of the development aspect is going in Asia, which I already mentioned. Sorry, maybe I extend one more minute.
No extension. You have 40 seconds.
Okay. So, which is going in Asia? Obviously, it is going to create more pressure on the minority groups, on the IPAs and things like that. So, their social security aspect is going to be very crucial in coming days. I have to mention the women in the development process. Their social security aspect is going to be very crucial in coming days. So probably Forum Asia can take this very niche, which is overlapping human security and human rights together, and bring something and offer something to the regional mechanism process on in terms of social security, social insurance, and whatever term we want to use, but the goal is the same, which is a realization of the dignity of the people. Thank you.
Thank you, Ota. At the back.
Thanks. Miwa from Freedom House. Interesting discussion. I'm just wondering the title of the discussion, the role of social construct in realizing real human rights or deconstructing realizing human rights. All these terms are jargons. And so anyway, I just wanted to be a little bit getting more realistic sense from panelists, especially Ochun, to, if you don't mind, to give us a somehow inspirational example from Asia. Maybe more than one if you have, and perhaps one from, you know, more than one sub-region, maybe, if you could, about, you know, what you mentioned, using these definitions as a tool to get a social or political change, you know, mobilizing the demand in the process, as you mentioned. So I just wanted to say that. Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to get the panel, then I'll come back. I remember both of you, but let's get the discussion continuing.
I think the reason why I avoided the defining social security clearly or social protection clearly was we can have so many different terms and concepts referring to this important aspect of human life, which should be guaranteed by society as a whole. I think in history, not in Asia, in the world, we have so many experiences about expanding freedom in many senses. Sometimes expansion of political freedom can bring in social freedom too. Sometimes economic freedom can bring in political freedom too. Sometimes both freedoms can come together when there is a force driving for those two goals, two freedoms. French Revolution, it was an expansion of political rights and civil rights, and it improved kind of quality of life. But there was a kind of reaction, of course, but that was the turning point of human rights. And Russian Revolution, Chinese Revolution, and the 29th, President Roosevelt's kind of economic policy, New Deal policy, so many policies. It is not ideal. It's not kind of transcendental, ideal concept of social security. But that was the kind of progress. Every moment we made the progress in different dimensions of freedom or human rights. And I think that is the kind of a trajectory towards higher social security. When we assess the quality of two pictures like Van Dyck and some like, you know, if you have a Thai painter, whatever, I mean, you know, if you compare two pictures, we don't need kind of transcendental ideal criteria for the best picture in the world. We can instantly know which one is better because we have our own taste. And we have our own criteria. I think human development, human rights, and social development or social security can be like that. We can instantly know which one is better, which one is wrong. I think we all know that this world is not in good shape in terms of human rights development and social development. And we know what should be improved because we feel which one should be improved. So
It's not that difficult question. It's not kind of rocket science to improve social security, because we all know. And the answering to that question, if there is any experience or any case or definition of social security which improve society as a whole, I think we can find so many different experiences under the different terminology or concepts.
Okay. Thanks, Armando.
I think this debate must be understood as a political debate. It's an ideological debate, no? Otherwise, we can look for easy formula for that, easy schemes. There's no easy scheme for that. And there is a tricky question about relativism, no? To say, no, Latin America is different from Asia. Of course, it's different. But there is something very interesting. Neoliberal policy established the world as a one-dimension world. So we accepted neoliberal policies. It's a global policies. Why can't we accept the solidarian policies, no? A social protection universal approach as a global policy, no? I think we can. This is a political. So in this sense, the question is, how can we shift the hegemonic agenda from now? Since the 50s, the end of the 50s, we shifted the agenda from development to poverty alleviation, okay? And this shift was very negative in the sense of the human rights, since we substitute the ambition to have a full human rights perspective to certain arrangements around the idea of to reduce poverty impact. And then we propose reduce poverty. First was to eliminate poverty. Then it became a little bit too big for neoliberal policy. Then we reduced to alleviate poverty. Then there were too many poor people, so we reduced it to extreme poverty. Yeah. No? And then, so this shift of the agenda represents a continuous process of retirement of this debate of social protection. Because now we have all these schemes, no? The safety nets, very small amount of money for insurance, basic insurance, basic answers, whatever. And everything is around the market. And if we consider this history of economy and the opposition between liberal economists and, the liberal economy and the protectionism in terms of protection population from the interests of the capital and the free market and so on, we can observe that we are in a very complex moment because we need to establish the protection of population in face of the economy, the neoliberal economy. And this is a very complex debate because it's used to say that the darkest place is exactly immediately in the spotlight, no? Because you cannot see around. And sometimes my perception is that even the social movement accepted the ideological statement of new liberty, that's not possible to provide social protection for everybody. But when we examine the structure of our economy arrangements and organizations, first of all, it's very clear that most of our countries, in order to be competitive on global economies, they reduced the tax income of the state. No? And if we compare with the historical experience of the social democracies in Europe or whatever, we see that if we have less than 40% of your GDP as tax income, you are not able to finance universal policies. So you need to have tax, amount of taxes enough to finance universal policies. But in this sense, you are obliged to establish limits to the capital freedom. No? Let's say like this. And by other hand, you need to have public services. That's another important question. And in this sense, you need to dispute with this free market the offer of service for all classes. I used to say in Latin American debates and Africa everywhere, if we don't have a social protection proposal, including middle classes, you never have social protection universal approach in your countries, because you need to propose something for everybody. If you propose something only for the poor, it will be poor policies for poor people. That's the point.
Huh? Okay, Armando, can we take it? Okay. First Santosh, then over to me.
Thank you, Gerald. I want to sort of respond to several of the points that have come up from the floor. But I take Armando's remark as a starting point, as my point of departure. The triumph and the hegemony of neoliberalism. You know, the triumph and the hegemony of neoliberal ideology is far more visible in Latin America and in Africa than it is either in Southeast Asia or in South Asia. I think there is enough evidence of this from sheer outcomes. What do I mean by that? Over the two decades from 1980 onwards, that neoliberalism triumphed in Latin America and in Africa, you had nearly two lost decades, the 80s and the 90s, in terms of both economic growth as well as human development outcomes. Planning mechanisms, planning structures all disappeared. Under the influence of bank fund policies, what happened was that you got the disappearance of planning ministries, substitution of planning ministries by the dominance of the Ministry of Finance, which had three-year expenditure frameworks, but not planning. In Asia, not in one country, did planning go away. In China, after the 1979 economic reforms began, the State Planning Commission's name was changed to the National Development and Reforms Commission. That body became more powerful than it was before 1979. India's economic reforms began in 1991. It's now 21 years. We are writing the 12th five-year plan of the country as we speak. I've come away after having finished two chapters of the 12th five-year plan. There is a National Economic and Development Agency in Philippines. There is the NESDB, the National Economic and Social Development Board in Thailand. I could go on. Every time I go to any of the Latin American countries where I have many friends among economists, their big complaint and tale of woe is we have lost the ability to do strategic planning. They now are bringing their ministries of planning back, but after learning the lessons in a very hard way. What's the implication of all of this? The implication is actually, I'm referring now why in Latin America, Jorge, our Venezuelan friend there, why you have such a dominance of conditional cash transfers in Latin America and you don't have them in Asia. Well, you need them in Latin America and you need them much less in most Asian countries. It's only in Philippines and Indonesia, in a little bit in India, that you're beginning to get CCTs. Why? And I'm going to make a distinction within Asia. Give me more than 3 minutes. I'm sorry. We are talking about sort of continents here, so it's not easy to simplify everything in 3 minutes. You've got much higher levels of inequality. You already had very high levels of social stratification in Latin America. On top of that, you had two lost decades of economic growth, worsening inequality. And it's only with the recognition that the neoliberal ideology has not worked that people like Lula became successful, like all the sort of indigenous people who've become presidents of so many Latin American countries. And you needed the CCTs. You had no choice but to, because you needed a add-on SOP to alleviate the distress of the people that had been caused by lost decades. Now, I'm not for a moment suggesting that there isn't poverty in Asia, but there isn't in Southeast Asia the kind of inequality that you see in Latin America, which is the reason why the human rights discourse might be more dominant in Latin America than it is in Asia. However, it is becoming increasingly dominant in Asia as well, particularly in South Asia, because obviously the largest number of poor are in South Asia, no question about it. And surprise, surprise, in our in since our economic reforms began in 1991, within the last decade, we've actually begun talking of rights. I think of five rights, which have actually been, the principle has been recognized, and they have, and three of them have already been implemented. One, in India, the right to work. The National Rural Employment Guarantee in rural areas since 2005 guarantees everyone who wants a job to actually work for 100 days in the year, and the government is required to provide that right to work. That's one right that's in place. Second, a right to education came into existence in 2009. It didn't exist prior to that. It is on account of the very rapid growth that we've seen under planned growth over the last 20 years that we've been able to provide for a right to education. Third, a right to food is about to be implemented. The bill is in Parliament. It is probably likely to be passed within the next 6 months. There are two more rights which are very much under discussion. The right to health is actually very much under discussion. We're writing the 12th five-year plan as we speak, and it's almost certain that this 12th five-year plan is going to be a plan focused on health. Finally, the right to social security is being discussed. We already have a major recommendation by the National Commission on Enterprises and the Unorganized Sector, which has recognized the need for actually ensuring non-contributory social insurance for those in informal work. So what I'm saying, in other words, is that planning has enabled, in this period of rapid economic growth, to actually create the conditions and the rapid growth to enable some rights to be realized.
But thanks for giving some comparative points, and we'll get a second round of feedback from the crowd. Yes.
Thank you very much. I'll be much, much shorter than that. I don't have a...
Just a quick thing. I'm thinking one of the things that I think when Amanda was speaking that struck me is maybe we have this topic upside down. Maybe it should be the role of human rights in realizing social security. That maybe we should be looking at human rights as the tool to get to social security, to get to dignity, as opposed to dignity giving us human rights. And maybe that's the perspective we have, at least in Africa, that human rights is not the goal in itself. It's not the standard. What you're doing is using it as a tool, as you use other tools, to get to human dignity. And maybe that may make it much, much more palatable, much more, I think, simpler for many of us if we see it as how do you use human rights tools and how do you use the covenants and other things to actually realize social security. I think the bigger thing really is social security, as explained in this discussion, as rather than human rights as a goal. I think that's one of the first things. And in that context, I just want to also share with you about a new campaign that's emerging in South Africa. Around, and this is touching on what Amanda said, that the goal is to make the public utilities, the public services, good enough for the middle class and for everybody to go there. So it's not just for the poor. And then one of the emerging things is a campaign now, as South Africa heads to elections next year, about making sure that public officials access public services. So you're saying, if you want to become a member of parliament, you must access public schools. You must access public transport. You must access public hospitals. And that is, I'm not sure how long it will survive or how strong it will be. But I think it's an excellent way, an excellent tool to raise the standards of a public service level so people can be able to then engage in it. Because if the president, you know, is using a bus to go to work as we would like him to, and then, you know, it will certainly enhance the quality of the transportation in the country. And then the other thing that I have just a little bit of, you know, after this discourse on neoliberalism and how Africa lost two decades, I think one of the challenges I have with that explanation is that it's, you know, and Africa has gone through, so those of you who follow a little bit of Africa, we've gone through decades and decades of blaming others. We blame colonial rule, we blame Latin America, we blame Brazil, we blame the Americans for slavery, and this neoliberalism for me it's got a role to play. But at the end of the day, these African leaders made decisions. Nobody put a gun in their heads, they made decisions they didn't have to make. They didn't have to make. And what's interesting is that even though we lost growth in the 80s and the 90s, in 2003 there was the first action of the president when he was elected in 2003, and I generally support him, was making a declaration saying that this, from tomorrow, there shall be free primary education. Just like that. And growth rates shot up from minus 1% to 7%. So I'm not sure what the correlation is, but sometimes you just make radical statements that actually help in realizing social protection in a society. So I'm this thing of neoliberalism. I think the African, because one of the things that happened as well in the 80s and 90s is that as Africa got poorer, our leaders got richer. So it's not that money, there's less resources. I think there's much more stealing than had been before. And that money went off into other countries. So I really do not excuse our leadership, our pathetic leadership, for the mistakes they have made and say it's neoliberalism. That is their choice.
Okay. I think he's expanded the discussion of when you speak about neoliberal system, it's not the out there, it's already ingrained internal, you know, in our own country, so that's a good point. I'm going to take Ilchong, and then if I see no comments here, then I'll get back to the floor. Yeah?
Thank you. I just follow the Santosh's comment on planning, because it is related to economic, social, and cultural rights focus on violations of those rights. Planning, those planners, or the attendant, the idea behind planning is not focusing on poverty. It's about growth. You know, it's a kind of base up. You know, by making growth, we are trying to distribute those wealth and income gain through planning among people. That was the kind of original idea invented by Nordic countries. So in Scandinavian countries, they started planning. So that planning is a bit different from different types of plannings in Asia. In Korea, we have had planning, but it was not well. There was a certain distribution, but it was not kind of based on good redistribution system. I don't know much about India. I think there must be some kind of certain limit. But planning, the original idea behind this planning was kind of to base up the society's income and wealth and distribute those among people. And this has an implication about our focus on violation of economic, social, and cultural rights. Because if we focus on violation of economic, social, and cultural rights, we have a tendency to focus on extreme poverty and hunger. Assumption behind this is, well, vulnerable people, okay, that is acceptable. Poor people, well, that is acceptable. But this extreme poverty is not acceptable, so we have to define it as a violation of human rights. But it's not. Those poor people, those vulnerable people are violated. Their rights are violated. So I think we have to move on or go beyond this focus on violation of economic, social, and cultural rights. Of course, technically, we can start with this procedure to focus on violation. But we should not rely on this assumption that where poverty, a certain level of vulnerability will be okay. Yeah? We have to get rid of this assumption and we can start with focusing on violation.
Okay, thanks. Rebecca, and then a quick comment by Armando, and then back to the floor.
You just added, actually, I think something that is important for us to discuss in terms of economic and social rights is this development of this category of extreme poverty, which in fact isn't recognized in the covenant and is not, it's a very new category. And I think those of us who've been working on economic and social rights do actually question this categorization, because in the covenant, the understanding is an adequate standard of living. That's housing, water. It's not extreme poverty or poverty, an adequate standard of living. Of course, there may be, that may be contextualized in different countries, but extreme poverty is very much lowering the bar from what the covenant is supposed to be guaranteeing. And I think as human rights, defenders and activists, we should really be pushing back on this idea that extreme poverty is the baseline for,
a violation. The other comment I wanted to make is in terms of how we discuss, and this is actually also really a question, I think that it's intuitive that the reason what we're discussing human rights and social security is ensuring a certain level of dignity and a life without poverty. Those of us who are using the human rights framework, I think, and you can tell me if you agree, but the reason we do so is because it defines duty bearers and rights holders, and it gives us an ability to claim violations, but also to claim positive obligations. And so I'm just wondering if those of us who are human rights activists, as we may want to think about the terminology that we use, not only in terms of social security, social protection, etc., but how we define the obligations on the states. And if we're using the concept of dignity, although I think it's inherently obviously true, right? That's what we're trying to get to. I'm wondering if, in terms of our advocacy, it also brings the debate back into a place of issues around morality or charity, or and it takes us away from a place where we're talking about inherent rights. I think it could be a different question to say, do we want to push the human rights discussion to an idea of a right to dignity? I mean, that's not although there are some organizations that are discussing a right to dignity, but I think the content, it would be extremely unclear and very subjective. And so I think maybe we also want to think about how we're talking about the rights and the need to, or the usefulness of a human rights framework versus other, perhaps moral arguments in the way that we're describing, what we're claiming.
Okay, I'm going to ask Santosh, and Armando's asked for the mic, but just going to get the final round of response, then we'll read together. So you just hold on to your comments because it may link. Who wants to take? I see one, two, and I can take one more if there is. Three. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, the mic is with you. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Virat. Actually, I have 2 points, and
introduce yourself, please.
Sorry. Oh, I am Mubarak Akhund from Bangladesh, and my organization is ASK. And already, Maya and Armando reflected on 1 point partly, but still, I need to have comments from the panelists. The challenges of realizing social security in the situation where all the fundamental services are going to be privatized, and the multinational companies are getting more and more powerful, and most of the government has no power to conflict with them to some extent. So in this situation, how it would be possible to realize the social security adequately from the public sector? That is one. And number two is specifically to Mr. Santosh. You mentioned about the non-contributory social insurance. I'm a little bit curious to hear from you the idea, the whole idea. If it is possible, please reflect on that. When every citizens are contributing through taxes, then how you are saying that non-contributory insurance could be taking place? Thank you.
Okay, the other person first, and then you come. No, not this. The person at the back. You go ahead. You can go ahead first.
Okay. Well, there are too many points to make, but I'll be very brief within 3 minutes. Number one, I have a problem with this whole topic itself. I am Neeraj Jain from Pune, India, a part of the anti-nuclear movement in India. You see, it's not a question of role of social security in realizing human rights. All the rights, right to education, right to wealth, everything is a right. So we should say that, how do you define it. As this lady rightly pointed out, this whole frame of this discussion fits in with what the multinationals want, that you provide tidbits for the poor, as our friend from India, Santosh, pointed out. That's what Planning Commission is doing. You know, they are planning poverty. The Planning Commission today is defunct. The Planning Commission plans how to give people tidbits, while India today is amongst the most unequal countries in the world. How can you say we are becoming egalitarian? We are violating the Constitution. You have a right to work. The NRGA is a joke. They don't provide funds. They only have it on paper. The right to education is actually a right to no education, because the word free is missing from the draft. It is not there in the document. The right to education is a right. If they are privatizing education, now they are privatizing schools. The whole thing is being privatized. Then you said right to food. That's another joke. In this country, you have a below poverty line, and the government declares without statistics that this is the number of people who are going to be poor. So the state governments are told you can only distribute so many below poverty line cards. It does not fit in. You see, another government commission says that 70% people in this country live on less than rupees 20 a day. And then another government committee says they are debating on the number of poor people in the country, whether the number of poor people in this country is 30%, 40%, or etc., etc., when already one report has said that less than rupees 20 a day, less than this bottle of water, that many people, 70% of the people live below that. The government is debating whether the poverty line should be 2 bottles of water or not, 30 rupees or not. That is the debate taking place in India. It is shameful. And then they say right to health. You are privatizing healthcare. It's a part of the agenda of the World Bank being imposed on India. So this logic, I mean, I'm surprised that you have such statements from this session. I can't believe it. The reason is you have a debt of $340 billion on India. That's the figure now. And so we are accelerating globalization, because how do you repay this debt? You can only repay it by taking more loans. And so the multinationals have their hands on our neck, and therefore our economic policies today in the Planning Commission, Montesinghe Ahluwalia and all these people, most of them are people from the World Bank. Now our chief economic advisor is Raghuraman Rajan, who's come from Chicago. You don't have economists in India, of course you have, but you don't have World Bank agents. So you have World Bank agents coming to India and dictating policies. Yeah, the last point. Just one point. One second. On Maina's comment, I would just want to say, I agree with you, but I would like to say that the leaders of these countries are in collusion with the multinationals. So I'm not exonerating the blame, but I'm saying that you have to see the collusion. They are colluding to sell out their countries. Thank you.
Most important thing, my name is Lenin Ragbansi. I represent from the People's Vigilance Committee on Human Rights, membership-based organization. We have the 50,000 members in the four state of North India. Most important thing, actually, this whole rights, the NRGA, National Rural Health Mission, and the right to education, only came due to by the people's struggles. So both of them, Santoshji and him, I am the part of that struggle. They are not giving us just like a charity. That is the strong campaign and movements of the people from the grassroots to compel them and use these contradictions within the Congress party. We know there is a Monte Carlo, but there is also the discussion about the Amjan, matlab common people. And that is pushed from the, they are listening the ground people, because we have little bit franchisee rights and other things and like that. And that is helping. I will tell you, when I am on the grassroots level, there is a Damahi village, 4 people died of the hunger. And when we activize through the National Human Rights Commissions and through our urgent appeal and the mass mobilizations on the grassroots level, they receive the NRGA Antodaya card and the accessibility to health scheme, there is no hunger deaths in 2-3 years. So most important thing, we know that, and there is a problem of the neoliberal policies, but I am just supplement to Santosh and his compliment. This right we achieve by struggle of the poor people of our country. They are not giving into the charity to us, and we are going to achieve. The bureaucrats are not going to decide. Next election, you look what is going to happen in 2014. And we are going to compel the government of India. Again, the Monte Carlo Alia and these people are not going to come. We compel them on the weaver issues. They give the 8,000 crore rupees to the weaver of this country. So don't insult the people's movement. Maybe we achieve little bit. Not fully. But it is not by the charity boss. It is not by the World Bank. They are compelled by us. World Bank is also discussing about in 2006 distributive justice. Why? Because this is compelled by the people's movement all over the world. So it is just not become very sectarian, subjective, little bit objective in this way to understand the respect to the people's struggle also.
Okay, thank you very much. I think with that we come to the final. One Southeast Asian voice. And then
Thank you. I think you hear a lot from South Asia. But why not from Southeast Asia, Cambodia? I'm Vanda from Ad Hoc Association in Cambodia. In Cambodia we have privatization for most of the public institution. But it's not mean poor people need to pay for the private sector, like private hospital and things like that, but poor people also need to pay much for public services, hospital, education. You know, filing complaint to the police, poor people need to pay 20 US dollars for one complaint. If not, if you don't have money, no need to file complaint. The police would not look at the complaint. So poor people in Cambodia paying too much money for private sector as well as public sector. That is bribe, you know. That is corruption. I don't say corruption. I say theft, stealing. You know, it's the right word. So I remember one time I participated in a workshop of regional workshop conducted by American NGO talking about responsibility to protect and discussing about function and mandate of R2P in this region. I request that any country that make the people poorer and poorer, let the people die slowly because of starvation and food security, must be put under R2P, you know? So, and my simple question is that what happened to the state, any state that failed to provide social security for the poor people especially? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So panelists, you're in the last round. So if you need to, you can go up to 5 minutes for this last round. But if you don't need to, I'll be happy to take your 3 minutes. So who wants to go? Santosh, you want to think about? Okay, Ilchong, you can. Okay.
I think the, thank you very much for comments from Indian friends. And that was something I didn't talk about when I talk about the kind of the meaning of planning. I think the planning should be based on democracy, and that is most important thing, because as I said, if planning is aiming at both growth and redistribution, it cannot be done without people's consensus and support. So I think the democracy and people's movement and participation is one of the most important components to make planning beneficial for all. And the question about how to realize social security, I think our institution was established to find out the way
to realize social security for all. We are talking about social security for all, not social security for a small group of elites. So when we talk about social security, we should think about universal social security. I think there are several ways, different paths to achieve universal social security. Every country has different historical, cultural, political, economic context. So every country should have their own strategy, but we can provide some principles or main ingredients to make that kind of specific strategy for each country. First, I think we have to strike the balance between growth and redistribution. Without something, we cannot redistribute. So we have to produce first, and then we have to redistribute. Without production, we cannot redistribute. Without redistribution, production can be meaningless. So we have to think about both sides. I think human rights groups should think about macroeconomic management of country in this sense. We have to think about redistribution, but we also have to think about redistribution. And we are living in capitalist economy. Capitalist economy always produces failure. You know, somebody is excluded from the market. We have to protect those people who are temporarily or chronically excluded from market. So we need to pay attention to protection. And we have to pay attention to reproduction. We talked about reproductive rights. Without social reproduction, society cannot be sustainable. So I will suggest we have to think about four dimensions of society. Production, redistribution, protection, reproduction. So I think human rights perspective should be embedded on these four dimensions. I think that is one principle. Second principle is again related to democracy. We talked about democracy a lot, but democracy has different meanings. Sometimes we talk about just election mechanism, but it's not all about democracy. The essence of democracy is about participation, meaningful participation. That means we need education, free space for open discussion, and freedom to dissent the kind of a government authority or whatever dominant ideology. So people's movement should fight for those spaces. We have to secure free space for open discussion. Without open discussion, we cannot achieve embedment of those human rights into these four dimensions. But we have to be very careful about one thing. We cannot be always right. Sometimes our counterpart can be right. I think that is the beauty of free and open discussion. And that is the beauty which makes us to strengthen our capacity to make us much more logical. I think that kind of principle is needed to realize social security. I talked about two pillars.
20 seconds more.
Okay. Four dimensions of society working and democracy. I think there are so many others, but I would like to suggest those two kind of principles. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sorry, Il-Chung and the panelists, we're just constrained by time. We're coming to the close. So, Rebecca, you want to... You have something, if not...
I'm only going to say it because it's important, but it's not really a summary. But I think as we're discussing these issues... with all rights, but particularly in relation to Social Security, particular groups that are concentrated in poverty are extremely relevant, particularly women, persons with disabilities, older persons. I think that it's true for all rights, but Social Security in particular, given its nature, which is often tied to labor or various social roles, that as we're discussing these, what these rights mean in concrete ways, that taking it away from what it means for particular groups of people might not get us to the place where we're actually realizing change in people's lives. And so just to remind us to keep these discussions, while of course these rights are universal, making them real for people requires discussing what it means in different people's realities.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm glad of this discussion. We have been really among the various groups, no, pushing for this transformative social protection. We are really trying to get this discussion going, because I think this is the time to assert, no, the concept of life of dignity. So for as principles, no, Elshong already mentioned that, no, for us, the social movements are actually now trying to come up with a strategy on how to reclaim these rights. Of course, how we can exact accountability from the state, and how to influence the planning processes of government, and how to create that spaces, no, for participation and engagement. And of course, this is this would require empowerment of the grassroots also, especially to have this effective way of reclaiming, of asserting the rights.
Thank you. Yeah, I think we leave the two heavyweights to sort out at the end on this issue.
Mainaka is just a sideshow.
So the rest of us are sideshows. These two are the three main people. Just a little thing in terms of emerging trends around issues like this is that, and I think I want to echo what one of our colleagues said about privatization. And I think that one of the big emerging trends around development and the whole concept of development is the privatization of development more and more. And I think that's going to be a huge challenge to all of us. And at the same time, you see a shrinking of the space for civil society within development. And that's an emerging trend, which I think is very dangerous for us. So even as we're discussing social security, social protection and human rights, I think the danger of renewed privatization, it's not being called Washington Consensus anymore, and it's really now going to development, is something to keep our eye on.
Thank you. Armando?
Well, I think we need to be reasonable on this debate about social protection. We need to ask for all rights immediately. No? That's what is reasonable in this field. No? So, because politically speaking, if we accept the progressiveness of socio-economical rights, we will never have these rights. Okay? So it must be very clear, politically speaking. Of course, when we decide that, no, when we adopt this political decision as movement, and then when we achieve to install this as a public policy, a state policy, we have a quite long journey to fulfill the complete answer to population. But the question is to move towards that, and then to shift the agenda, asking how to do that, no? And to move. Our national experience in Brazil, when in 1988 we adopt a new constitution, and we define it, the right to social security, no? Including a very polemic aspect, that the universal right to health, we excluded all kind of insurance concept, because the insurance concept is a very tricky concept, because when you adopt the insurance concept, you are establishing a kind of hidden dialogue between benefits and contributions in the way you finance it. You know? So the insurance concept is something that we eliminate at that moment of debate. We adopted the universal approach as a human rights inspired approach. And since the first day of the new constitution, we adopted the idea that all dimensions of health and healthcare will be covered, you know. Because then we provoke a kind of crisis, immediately crisis, you know, in order to make possible to have all the health facilities, the health professionals, the budget, etc. It means that in Brazil we have a universal health system that covers all kinds of treatment. You can change sex, you can have all oncology therapy, you can have all drugs, etc., etc. Transplantation. Yeah? Of course, the consequence of this 23 years of process is that we are still fighting for enough budget. But our budget nowadays, our public expenditure on health is $370 per capita per year. What is quite significant. If you compare with the per capita of most of the countries, the South countries, is high. It's not enough because what we propose to cover is everything. So we are now fighting to have at least $1,000 per capita. And they say, is it possible? Yes, that's the point. It's possible when you understand that the main goal of the economy of a country is to sustain a social protection process in order to have dignity for everybody. This is the reason to have a nation. This is the reason to have a government, to have a state. Otherwise, it's nothing. It's a nonsense, you know? So link economy to the effort to have the full human rights answers, no? Is something that's extremely important. And by other hand, there is a link between political dimensions and social economical rights. That is, if we don't have this full rights approach to this social protection, what will substitute that is the favor, the clientelism, no? The paternal relationship. Because if you have a scarce right, what will happen is that you have a kind of black market of rights. And then you need somebody that will intermediate your possibility to have the material expression of the right. And then begin all the kinds of favors, dependencies, no? And so. So it's a matter of quality of democracy. Boaventura Sousa Santos, a Portuguese sociologist, used to say that a democracy with no social justice is just a formality. Okay? So the sense of democracy is social justice. If there is no social justice, there is no democracy, finally. So this link in terms of political structure of our fight is extremely important. And I said that we need to be reasonable because we need to ask immediately. No? It's not a progressive, it's not depending on the resources. We need, politically speaking, make this statement about that and radically demand the immediate
20 seconds
conception of universal social protection. To be universal means include everybody, not only the so-called poor, everybody, and the answers must cover all needs of everybody and needs to look for equality through really equity policies, no? So, and in this sense, to conclude, I think we need to make a very clear difference of the speech of the World Bank and the neoliberal policies. Equity doesn't mean to have targeted policies, okay? And then there is opposition between universalism approach and targeted, so-called by the World Bank, equity policies. It's not that. I mean, it's necessary to be clear on that. And the other point is that we need to clean our speech. I mean, we need to abandon the semantic of the hegemonic neoliberal policies. Risk, vulnerable. That is not, it's not the way to build public policies. No? So we need to be much more coherent with the human rights perspective to have a new semantic on that in order to have new policies. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Armando. And final comments by Santosh.
Thank you all, first of all, for really enlivening this debate.
Let me re-emphasize some of the points that Ilchong and Armando in particular have made about the need for deep democracy. We in India have felt the need for increasing the depth of our democracy over time, which is one reason why increasingly it is clear that without the people's movements, we wouldn't be at the point where we are of having realized at least three of the five rights, which I believe are absolutely essential for dignity, which all of us are all agreed upon. The five rights being the right to education, the right to health, the right to food, the right to work, and the right to social security. In passing, I will mention something for our tribal people, for instance, a right which they have not had for 60 years of our nation's existence, a Forest Rights Act. You know, our tribal people, they constitute about 8% of our country's population. As of 2006, they now have a Forest Rights Act. What does that mean? They've always been, most of them, forest dwellers. And they had, for centuries, access to the produce of forest, which was often taken away by the forest department of the government, the produce was, and then given off to contractors. That right has been returned to the tribal. It's a huge achievement, which is the result of people's movement. So I would strongly emphasize that we are at that great moment in history where people's movements are making a huge impact. If we won the Right to Information, and the Right to Information Act became an act of Parliament of 2005, it is because of people's movements. We are seeing a process of a democratization, of a deepening of democracy in our country, and it is actually making huge impacts. So I want to re-emphasize that, the learning that we are coming away. Let me also refer to a few of the points that came from the floor, where people were asking direct questions to me. The question rose, is it possible to have non-contributory social insurance, especially for the extreme poor? I'm convinced that it is financially possible to have non-contributory, which is, in other words, financed by the state. For those who are above the poverty line, you can have a semi-contributory, part contribution, part matching. But for those below the poverty line, it is perfectly possible. I've done the costing for it for the entire nation, for our country, and it costs barely 0.11% of GDP at 2007 prices. And which is the reason why there is growing acceptance in our country of social insurance for those who are in the unorganized sector. After all, we already have a non-contributory health insurance called the RSBY. I don't have the time to talk about it. We already have a non-contributory old age pension for those below the poverty line, and so on and so forth. Let me turn to my dear and very passionate friend here, who decried all of these, legal victories, I think, which we have won, which the poor people in our country have won, which is the right to education, the right to work in the National Rural Employment Guarantee. Yes, there is corruption. But when was there not corruption earlier? In the Rural Employment Guarantee in our country, for the first time in the history of our nation, has enabled the landless peasant to say to the landlord where he used to work, bugger off. I can go and work for a public employment scheme. I don't have to work for you. What has been the result of that? The result of that has been the following. When earlier he used to get, till about 5 years ago, I used to be, by the way, the head of the Rural Development Division of the Planning Commission, so I know these facts like the back of my hands. The open market wages before the Rural Employment Guarantee Act was 50 rupees a day for men and 40 rupees a day for women. Today, in fact, two years later, just as soon as the act came into existence, it had already doubled. It had already doubled. What was the result of that? Not only were these the wages being paid by the public sector employer, these were the open market wages being paid by that erstwhile landlord, because this now landless peasant was able to say
to this landlord, bugger off. I won't work for you if you don't pay me these wages. His incomes have risen very significantly. It is not for nothing that poverty, that the proportion of a population below the poverty line has declined. Of course, you have 300 million people who are
because
there's a huge, you know, I'm closing. What I'm saying is there are factual errors in the statements that the gentleman was making. Finally, the factual error. You really need to have the facts before, you know, you start believing everything that is said in great passion.
No, let him finish his speech. Niraj, Niraj. Niraj, we can have a talk outside. Niraj.
No facts being distorted. I'm sorry to say. I already began by saying when he was not even here to listen to the fact that people's movements have actually made a huge contribution to the deepening of our democracy.
Don't worry.
Because for anyone to think that India's debt is larger than its foreign exchange reserves is a sheer distortion of fact. India's external debt is barely 20% of its total debt. Most of our debt is 80% of our debt is actually domestic. We are perfectly capable of paying it. And there is
Niraj, we have a just a second. Niraj, we had a decorum, and he's right. We gave you the respect, we gave you the time, and we'll demand that of you. And the Indian debate will not be finished in this forum. So, if you want. As Santosh has already said, you can have this discussion after this bilaterally, and I would ask you and seek for you not to stand up and take over the floor, and because we're going to close the session, and this was his final statement, and I think he's right. He was saying, he was giving credit to the statement earlier by Lenin of the contributory factor of the change. So he's entitled to his viewpoints based on his experience and facts and figures. And you have said yours very clearly. It's documented. It's recorded. So we have both viewpoints. After this, we can go front and back and forth for a long time. But I think, are you done? Can I close it? Okay. So thanks, Santosh. Thanks to all the panelists. But there are many questions. But what to do? Our debate, our forum is only limited by time. And the questions of 5 billion, 7 billion people will not be answered in a short time. But I think the elements of what we are working towards have arisen. So we have not closed the panel yet, but before I move on, let's give a round of applause to all of our six panelists who have done very well. Yeah. I think what has come up is that first the reaffirmation that I don't think there was this disagreement that is the dignity for all people. I mean, we all spoke in different languages. It was a human rights, even the starting point, you know, the semantics, the conceptualization. I think no one here disagreed that it was a rights-based approach. That we are talking about human rights. But what's the concept and idea of social security? When do we call on this right under Article 9? We have not really enumerated it very well. And I think based on this discussion, there is definitely dimensions beyond semantics. It's an ideological dimension for sure, because I think there's enough examples from Kenya to Venezuela, Brazil, even India, of all other countries, of this neoliberal economic policy that is happening. The dimension of privatization that is happening. And like what Maina Kai said, that the privatization of development. You know, sometimes we're also making jokes in Malaysia and all that. You know, privatize everything, you might as well privatize the government. We don't need a government, you know. So this is staring us at the face, how much we are going to go in that. It's already happening already. Okay, so but it's an ideological debate. But at the heart of it, you and I as people of our nation, we want to take it to a political dimension. And that political dimension is somewhat, I think it was Rebecca who mentioned that the duty bearer of this right is the government. As the system, at least we hope, in a more perfect world, that's why you have systems in place, and that's why we have Santosh and many others who get into this process of planning and budget monitoring, budget policy. I think it's a given. I think Santosh will also agree with me that it's not perfect. It's far from perfect, you know. The progression, the changes has happened incrementally in some places. Some, the gaps are so huge. Corruption is happening. Santosh agrees. Kenya showed us extreme example. Cambodia said, you need US 20 to make a police report. How are you going to function as a government? But I think the political will of states to ensure human rights for all is, I think, the debate before us. Are governments going to say progressive realization, so don't bug me for now? I'm a bit busy planning. No, you can't say that, because it's all human rights for all now. And that's part of the debate or the difficulty we are having in our country, which is the bottom line question is money. I think Mainakai said that, do we really not have money during all the 80s, 90s? Oh, how was the money used? Which guns did we buy? Which people pocketed the money and is now sitting in some safe bank somewhere? And this is a crime of all our nations together, from the US, Korea, Malaysia. I mean, it's happened and it's happening. I think so. It's not the lack of resources. There is a lack of political will. And linked to that, I think, the earlier point by Santosh about examples of governance. And that's where the deep democracy comes in. And that whole point of the type of democracy. And I think I like to transform democracy to the word Sabat used about participation. If we talk about human rights or social security, it's not about somebody outside.
Check out our other podcasts available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. If you have any suggestions for future podcasts, email us at press@unris.org. Thank you for listening.